Hi, it's Diane. Great to be with you. On my mind, recognizing the men and women on the front lines of America's longest wars. The Medal of Honor is the military's highest tribute for bravery. Established in the 1860s, it's been awarded more than 3,500 times, 25 of those in the conflicts since 9/11. James Kitfield is a journalist who covered the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. As the 20th anniversary of 9/11 approached, he began gathering stories of these most recent Medal of Honor winners. What emerged was a picture of bravery, camaraderie, and a unique on-the-ground view of America's longest wars. His book is titled In the Company of Heroes. James, we are marking the anniversary, the 20th anniversary of 9/11. During that time, you've written about defense and national security, mostly on the policy level. Now you've written a book about the heroes that came after 9/11. Talk about why you decided to do that.
You know, Diane, as you mentioned, I've covered these wars both from the decision-making in Washington to covering them from Afghanistan and Iraq. And for National Journal, I always wrote at that strategic sort of 30,000-foot level where the generals have to decide what to do, where politicians decide what to do about the war. But I was always so impressed by the young men and women who are on the front lines who are impacted most by those decisions. So I always had it in my mind that I wanted to write about them at some point. And as the war started to wind down, I started thinking very seriously about that. And I got my opportunity when the Department of the Navy reached out to me and offered me an exclusive interview with a Navy SEAL, Britt Slavinsky, who had just received the Medal of Honor, and got to talk to him. And his story was just so dramatic and Homeric, all these decision points where he could have done the easy thing, but they just chose to do the hard thing and put their lives on the line to go retrieve from a mountaintop one of their colleagues who had fallen out of a helicopter. And it was almost certainly a suicide mission. But they, to a man, that this team went back up to try to find that person. One of them was shot and presumed dead. Another one was shot, lost his leg. They ended up in this furious fight with Al-Qaeda. Quick Reaction Force tries to save them, and their helicopter is shot down, losing more of their colleagues. And miraculously, the soldier who, the Air Force sergeant who was presumed dead and shot, comes back to life, if you will, after they retreat off the mountain, and engages in a furious fight with this, you know, outnumbered from these Al-Qaeda fighters, fights to the death, finally exposes himself to fire to try to give cover to that Quick Reaction Force helicopter, and he's killed. So it was it was just this unbelievable story of bravery and tenderness too, because, you know, they were not going to leave that guy on that hill, on that mountaintop, even though trying to rescue him was almost certainly a suicide mission. So that got me thinking about, I want to hear more of these stories about these people, because I think they're indicative of this all-volunteer force we have and where we've sent it in the last 20 years, in some pretty tight places.
You've raised a number of points I want to follow up on. First, this Navy Senior Chief SEAL, Britt Slavinsky. Give me a little of his background and why he became a Navy SEAL and how he ended up with a Medal of Honor.
So his father was a Navy SEAL. And as a young boy, he would go to these reunions of his father's unit and just saw that camaraderie these guys had, even years and years after their service was finished. And he wanted to be part of that. And of course, he was an Eagle Scout, a great athlete. And as soon as he could, he enlisted and tried to get through Naval SEAL training, which is probably the toughest military training there is. He never looked back after that. He loved it.
And it's so extraordinary that every single person in these wars was a volunteer.
Right. So, you know, I've covered the all-volunteer force in my earlier book, Prodigal Soldiers, because I went into the creation of it. And what was amazing is that a lot of these guys did volunteer after 9/11, knowing they were going into combat and being sent to war, which is, you know, the most horrific thing you can endure. But they joined anyway because they wanted to help defend their country from another 9/11 type attack. But I have to tell you, the architects of the all-volunteer force would never have dreamed that the country would send it off to fight for 20 years without reinforcing and mobilizing the country with a draft. The fact that we didn't do that meant that these one percenters, because they're 1% of the population, had to go back time and time again, combat deployment after combat deployment, which is very tough on strain on families. There are studies that link that the more combat deployments you go into to combat to post-traumatic stress. So they have borne a disproportionate share of these conflicts. And one thing I think that is disorienting to them is that, you know, they come back from war and they find a country that's not been at war. The saying goes, you know, I went to war, America went to the mall. And that itself is psychologically disorienting because they've gone through these horrors of war. And they come back and the country's not even paying attention. And I think that has been a stress producer for this all-volunteer force as well.
Of course, as we mark 9/11, it's really so much about what happened on that day. And we're not thinking so much about what happened afterwards. And as you said, the one percenters who then followed orders and went first to Afghanistan, then to Iraq, which you and I were totally against. I'm so glad you've written this book to remind us of the people who went to Afghanistan, to Iraq, to help maintain the safety of this country for the 20 years since.
Absolutely. And of course, we've all been watching these horrific images from Afghanistan, and I'm getting questions from people who served saying, you know, was this in vain? You know, the Taliban are sweeping back. And my comment is always, no, your service was not in vain. When I was in Washington on 9/11 and reporting about the attack on the Pentagon and in New York, every counterterrorism person I talked to, expert, and I talked to many of them, over the couple of years after 9/11. And they all said that, you know, we're going to get hit again with a terrorist spectacular similar to 9/11. It's going to happen. It's inevitable because we have to be on the defensive. You have to be perfect all the time, and the terrorists only have to be perfect once. But that didn't happen. It didn't happen because we sent the military over there and they put constant pressure. They decimated the leadership of Al-Qaeda. They decimated the leadership of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. They killed every leader of ISIS, the leader of Al-Qaeda, the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So they've kept intense pressure on these groups. And the reason they haven't hit us is not because they quit trying. It's because we were constantly pressuring them, denying them sanctuary in places like Afghanistan. And that's why we haven't been hit for the last 20 years. So that service has definitely not been in vain. It's kept this country safe. Now the question arises, can we continue to keep our country safe now that Taliban are back in Afghanistan?
How many Medal of Honor winners were there in those wars?
25. They call themselves recipients because I had said that to one of them too. You know, I referred to him as a winner, and I was told, you know, this is not something you win. This is something you earn, and it's a weighty award, Diane, for these guys because in almost every case, it reminds them of the worst day of their lives. And so a lot of them don't like to talk about, you know, what happened that day. They described it as a very weighty burden because they see themselves as a stand-in for the people who didn't come back and the colleagues that were lost. And so they bear this award and do some public speaking about it frequently because they want to draw attention to their colleagues who were also showed extreme valor, and especially the ones who came back injured or didn't make it back at all.
Do you think many, if not most, were resentful of the non-military population when they returned?
I did not get that from them. One reason why is the country learned something from Vietnam. If you'll remember back then, we made the mistake as American public to conflate an unpopular war with the people we sent to fight it. And, you know, they came back and they weren't respected very well. It's not been the case for the all-volunteer force. They're the most by far respected institution in the country. They are constantly told, you know, thank you for your service. Like I said, what has disoriented them to them, I think, is the fact that the country is not really on a wartime footing, but they're fighting these wars on multiple deployments. So there is that. That's disorienting. But I didn't pick up any resentment from them. These men and women are very proud of their service. They've been part of something bigger than themselves, which is contagious for them. And I think that they're not really resentful, but just kind of disoriented by the fact that, you know, the country just didn't seem to be at war when they were.
Does each of them, including you, have a memory of where you were on 9/11 and why that so inspired them to go forward and volunteer?
Sure. Well, I mean, and some of them were serving even before 9/11, but you know, like Britt Slavinsky and John Chapman, who I described in that first battle, they were both part of special forces. Both of them were working out in gyms, which they do a lot of in special forces, and saw on TV the World Trade Center go down, and they knew immediately where they would be going in the next couple of weeks. That's something kind of unusual about special forces. They always know if there's a big crisis, they're likely going to be sent there. But there were a number of the Medal of Honor recipients who joined after 9/11, as I said, knowing they would go into combat. And, you know, everyone has their memories of 9/11. I remember I was downtown Washington. I had just driven by from my home in Arlington to my office of National Journal downtown, right by the Pentagon where that plane came in. And so I just missed that. But, you know, when we were just watching in the newsroom what was going down, and I just knew in the next few years of my life, it turns out a lot more than that, we're going to be spent trying to figure out what happened, why it happened, how we can keep it from happening again. I remember people from the newsroom when we heard the second plane hit, we told anyone who had young children, go pick them up and take them home, get out of here. Because we knew that there was a plane that was still in the air that was probably headed for the Capitol. That was the one that the heroic passengers, you know, stormed the cockpit and forced it down in Pennsylvania. No one knew what was going to happen that day. And it was so weird. I remember seeing warplanes fly right overhead in Washington, blue sky, beautiful day. Just seemed like so surreal. The events were just so surreal.
Indeed. One of the legacies of this war has been the number of veterans who are suffering from PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome. And many of these men, I would think, have had much of that same experience.
Absolutely. I think to a person, they all have had a post-traumatic stress. One of them actually tried to commit suicide out of survivor's guilt.
Who is that?
Dakota Meyer, Marine Corps Corporal Dakota Meyer. He writes about it in a book that he wrote about putting a gun to his head and pulling the trigger. And some loved one had the foresight to take the bullets out. So he survives. But they all have struggled with post-traumatic stress. They've talked about it very publicly because they want their colleagues and combat veterans to know there's no shame, there's no stigma in seeking out help. What you've been through, I even kind of have quit calling it post-traumatic stress disorder because it's not really a disorder. It's a natural reaction to the trauma these guys have been put through. But I want to read us the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. It's 1-800-273-8255. Anyone who is feeling these things should call that prevention hotline. They are very familiar with the kinds of struggles that combat veterans have gone through, and they should reach out for help because there is no stigma to struggling with what the trauma you've been through because it's just not natural. It's the natural reaction is stress.
What happened to Dakota Meyer after he had attempted that suicide? What did he feel? What did he say? What did he do?
He had a dark night of the soul, and after that attempt, he decided that it was didn't live up to what the people he lost in combat would have wanted him. You know, they would, as he said, they would have given all their tomorrows for just one day, and he wanted to sort of honor that. And basically, he keeps a bracelet on his arm with all the casualties who didn't make it home from the battle he fought in. And so he's always reminded of that he has a responsibility to try to live a meaningful life to honor the fallen.
James, what was that battle like that he fought in?
That was called the Battle of Ganz Gaul. It's a very tight valley that the Mujahideen had used to when they were the Soviet Red Army was in Afghanistan. Had used that valley to resupply their forces who fought the Soviet Red Army. So there's a long memory amongst the Taliban of that infiltration route. This whole force was walking into the valley to meet with some of the elders. They get ambushed. Dakota Meyer himself drove into the battle to rescue people and withdraw both Afghan national security forces as well as American forces in their armored Humvee, I think 5-6 times, and just horrific. They were getting shot up. He engages in hand-to-hand combat. It was just a very harrowing thing. That was another battle where actually two recipients won the Medal of Honor for that battle. The other one was Captain William Swenson, who was one of the senior persons on scene. And he also went back constantly. He lost his best friend in the battle, but he kept going back into the ambush to try to save wounded, and repeatedly did that. It was just amazing.
How many times did you go to Afghanistan?
You know, I was trying to remember, Diane, and I don't remember exactly. I'd have to go back and look at all my articles. I want to say, you know, 8 to 10 times over the years.
And where were you staying? Were you with the troops as they went out on their own searches? What were you doing?
I did some of that. I embedded myself with a unit that was in Coast Province, which is one of the sort of Indian country provinces right up against the Pakistani border, and went out and patrolled with them because I wanted to see what that was like. I was also doing a story on the Air Force liaisons who are attached to our ground forces. And, you know, it was frightening because I had actually done a story where I rode back with the medical evacuation flights from Afghanistan to Landstuhl, Germany, and then finally back to the States. And, you know, they're full of very, very severely wounded troops, because at that point, Afghanistan was a war of dismounted infantry. And there were a lot of improvised explosive devices that were hidden in dung piles and in goat carcasses and everything else. And you just never knew the next step. What would happen. And it gave me a really good sense of the bravery of all of these people who've served in that war, because that was a daily routine for them. I was there for a few weeks. So gave you a great appreciation for just the kinds of service that we demanded of our all volunteer force. What they went through was, they're all heroic in my mind.
Where did that bravery come from, do you think?
You know, one of the things that in this comes through in these stories is that some of them come from big cities, some of them come from small towns. They come from the Northeast, the South, the Mountain West, the Northwest. They come from all over the country, and there are just communities that create these really extraordinary individuals. So I think they bring a sense of commitment and values to the military. And of course, the military is very good at sort of polishing that into a team that looks after each other as their number one cultural value, if you will. So that goes to their motto of never leave a man behind. You go into war only and endure it, I think, only because you know the people around you have your back and that all of you would give your life for each other. And that comes through really strongly in these stories. In each of these stories, there's a kind of a brush with eternity. And instead of doing the easy thing or the safe thing, they go beyond and above the call of duty and put their lives on the line for their fellow troops. And it's pretty inspirational to hear about.
Were there any women on the front lines at that time?
None of the Medal of Honor recipients are women, and primarily because these are battles of the very tip of the spear. And for these wars, the women were not allowed into frontline combat units. I will say, though, that I ran into a number of women in units that, I mean, these wars had no front line or safe rear area. They were, you know, they were counterinsurgency wars. So you could be, I mean, whether you're driving a truck, I saw women in MPs who were, you know, riding around the war zones and firing their weapons. So women were in this war, and they were in this war in a big way, you know, female helicopter pilots and combat pilots as well. But this particular small group, those were kind of units that women were not allowed in at the time.
Talk about the story of Florent Groberg.
Yeah, Flo, they call him, he calls himself, he's a really good guy. He's an immigrant. His mother was from Algeria. He grew up in Paris. Was brought to the States as a young boy. He's Muslim, and he'd had an issue with this Islamist extremist sort of dirtying the religion's name. He joins the army. He is deployed. His mentor was a non-commissioned officer who he really respected. So he's leading a group through an Afghan town, and he's in charge of the security patrol. And so he's leading, you know, it's a very high ranking group of people. And he's marching through a town to meet with the governor of the province. And he sees a suicide bomber, guy's acting strange. So he walks up to him and he can see his vest. And so he bull rushes the guy away and then goes on top of him to shield the rest of the formation from the blast. He lives, his mentor dies, unfortunately, but, that explosion sets off another suicide vest from people behind them. So he basically neutralized two suicide bombers. But he was one of these really horrifically injured troops. And there are a number of them in these stories. And he talks about he had such survivor's guilt that he was losing his mind, he thought. I mean, he was literally in the hospital losing his mind. And, you know, they're all on heavily medicated and they're that plays with your mental situation. And he says he was saved by another trooper who had lost both arms and both legs, who was also rehabilitating at Walter Reed. And that guy came into his hospital room one night and said, you know, I know you're having a tough time, but there's people here who are having even worse. And you've got to, you know, rediscover the warrior in you. And it was a very emotional story, but he, you know, he went on to do great things and become, you know, an entrepreneur and just a great guy. But he was saved by someone who thought first of him, even though that person had suffered his own horrible injuries.
How much injury did Florent suffer?
Well, he lost most of one leg and almost lost both legs, but miraculously they saved his legs. He had, you know, traumatic brain injury he had to recuperate from. He was in really rough shape, but they were able to save his legs. He had been a elite runner in college, track star, and, you know, at the end he was just trying to save his legs so he could walk on them again.
A quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with James Kitfield.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here is the rest of my conversation with James Kitfield. His new book is titled In the Company of Heroes. So, James, what do you think this combination of stories tells us about this conflict in Afghanistan and Iraq?
You know, what's interesting, Diane, that it really traces the kind of the long arc of these wars. The first chapter I described to you of the SEAL team, that was the first time Operation Anaconda in 2002 that, you know, America's forces were really bloody. They fought Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters who didn't cut and run. They stayed and fought. And we lost a lot of troops in that fight. But it was an indication of the Taliban were going to be a lot tougher than a lot of people thought to subdue. The next chapter is actually a first-class Army Sergeant Paul Smith. He was engaged in a battle for the Baghdad airport. I was right behind them. I was embedded for that conflict. I lost one of my great friends and colleagues, Mike Kelly, in that battle. And so that was the Iraq invasion. There's a chapter on the Battle of Fallujah, which was the worst 2004 timeframe, which is the worst urban fighting our U.S. forces have been in since 1968 during the Tet Offensive in Hue. There is a number of guys whose battles were fought during the Iraq surge, if you'll remember, when we basically almost lost that war and surged troops there. And that was a hard-fought contest and a lot of heroic deeds in those battles. And there is multiple stories and Medal of Honors given to people who fought the Mountain Campaign in Afghanistan in the years hence. And that was when the U.S. military put these units in these really remote valleys trying to stop the infiltration of Taliban fighters into Afghanistan from Pakistan. And a lot of these units found themselves in really the most inhospitable terrain on earth, very hard to be reinforced, very hard for quick reaction forces to reach them, frequently outnumbered by the mountain fighters. The last battle of that campaign I describe in here because it also created two Medal of Honor recipients, and it was the Battle of Combat Outpost Keating. And that unit was virtually overrun and wiped out before they fought heroically to survive. But after that, we pulled out of that base, bombed it, and pulled all our troops out of the remote valleys of Afghanistan because it was just unsustainable. Tactically, it was unsustainable to put them in those positions. Just a lot of those outposts are just surrounded by high ground where you get shot at every day. They sometimes wouldn't even risk a trip to the latrine during daylight because you get shot at. So that was pretty harrowing. And then the final chapter is about an Army Ranger who runs into a burning building under fire three times to rescue 80 hostages that ISIS was about to execute. His name was Army Sergeant First Class Thomas Patrick Payne. Just a really heroic story and brings back that it's not just Al-Qaeda. You know, ISIS was a huge threat. We successfully decimated ISIS too, but it took hard fighting. And much of it was done, by our allies, but a lot of it was done by our special forces as well.
And given that Payne ran back and forth in there so many times, did he survive?
He did survive almost miraculously. And I interviewed him. He was the last one of these Medal of Honor recipients I interviewed. And he did survive. He had been wounded in a previous deployment. And he was an elite Army Ranger. He had been wounded in Afghanistan, thought he might have to leave the service because his leg was so badly wounded, but finds a way to rehabilitate. Comes back, wins the Ranger contest, which is this contest of special forces that is really elite, and then is deployed for this time and goes through this really harrowing battle and survives without major injury in that battle. Although he lost a couple of his colleagues were killed in that rescue mission. So again, all these stories are have a strong element of tragedy to them, but they are certainly inspiring.
Given that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have ended the way they have, do you get a sense from any of these men that it wasn't worth it?
I have not gone purposely back to these men to ask them about the current situation because I know it's gut-wrenching for them. I know it's heartbreaking for them. And I don't want to try to remind them, and I certainly don't want to try to drag them into the politics that you now see surrounding them, how badly Afghanistan withdrawal went. But I have talked to a number of senior active duty and retired military contacts, and to a person, everyone's just, they are it's like a gut punch has been described to me to see this, to see the Taliban sweep back in is just really heartrending for them because they expended the blood, sweat, and tears and know the colleagues that didn't return. So you can just imagine it's just horrible for them to see this. But I don't think that they think as I said earlier, that the service was in vain. I think they know that their service kept this country safe for the last 20 years. Now the question we have to ask everyone is, can we keep the country safe now that the Taliban is back? Will Al-Qaeda again have sanctuary to sort of establish training bases, et cetera? And what can we do about that? We are much better protected. We have more defenses than we used to have. We have much better intelligence. Now, we won't have as good intelligence in Afghanistan, though, because we won't have the, you know, spies on the ground like we've had for the last 20 years. But we have learned a lot. And so now the question becomes, you know, if you do see terrorist groups reestablishing sanctuary in Afghanistan, can you reach out and touch them and pressure them? Because if you unpressured, they will grow in strength. We saw this when we pulled out of Iraq in 2011. ISIS, you know, flourished and came back and almost captured Baghdad and, you know, captured a third of Syria and a third of Iraq. So that could happen again. And if it is, then maybe we're not done with Afghanistan because, you know, as one general said to me, you can be done with war, but wars might not be done with you. So we'll have to see. But having the Taliban, because they're ideologically fellow travelers with Al-Qaeda, and they've maintained, the Haqqani network is represented in their senior leaders. Those are some of the worst of the worst, very, very close to Al-Qaeda. So the people I've talked to in senior military ranks are not the least bit confident that Al-Qaeda will sort of reestablish roots in Afghanistan.
They're not confident.
They are not confident.
Well, you know, it all takes me back to what you were talking about earlier, the Soviet roots at the time. The Soviets were in Afghanistan and finally gave up. Could we ever have won this war in Afghanistan?
Diane, let me give you what the military's answers to that would be, which was that we were never going to win this war in a traditional sense where you have a surrender ceremony on the deck of a battleship or something. It was a threat that it's unconventional, it's asymmetric, and you manage it. And so they thought that they had gotten the situation in Afghanistan, much like they did in the fight against ISIS, where they managed it, where we brought all air power, some special forces, and backstopped local defense forces that were willing to fight and die for their own countries. And we did that with the Kurds in Syria and against ISIS and with the Iraq security forces. And we were doing that up until we started withdrawing troops seriously after the signing of the so-called peace agreement in 2020. So that's their argument, is that it was only 8,000 to 10,000 people required to do that. They always point out, you know, we still have troops, thousands of troops in Germany after World War II. We still have thousands of troops in Japan, in South Korea. We have had a tradition of leaving stabilizing forces behind to sort of solidify the gains you make from war. Unfortunately, in these cases, this forever war narrative took hold. And you had two presidents, President Trump and President Biden, from different parties who agree on nothing else except they wanted all American troops out of Afghanistan. And 70% of the American public said, we agree, we want American troops out of Afghanistan. So maybe the lesson there is that for democracies, it's very hard to sustain these kinds of very long gray zone conflicts. So if you ever think about regime change again, you might want to think twice about that, because they require very heavy lift over a very long time. And maybe we don't have the wherewithal to do that.
Finally, last week, I interviewed someone who had written a book saying, in effect, that the generals, the people in charge at the highest levels, had simply been lying to the American people about, quote, progress in Afghanistan.
I've read some of that, and some of that's coming from Craig Whitlock, who's a very good reporter for the Washington Post, has written the Afghanistan papers. I think to say that they were lying is a stretch. I think that the military has a built-in bias. It's called a can-do bias. And so if you give them a mission, they're going to salute, say, oh, yes, sir, can do. And they are going to do that as long as it takes to complete the mission. Was there a lot of can-do talk that was not, you know, that probably did not reflect some of the doubts they had? Yeah, absolutely, there was. And also we totally miscalculated how difficult it is to stand up indigenous security forces from scratch. We did that in both Afghanistan and Iraq, and it takes decades. I don't know why we think that's easy. For one thing, we're not very good at it because we don't have units that are trained in doing that one thing. So we do it kind of on an ad hoc basis. And, you know, in a place like Afghanistan, where 80% of the soldiers are illiterate, to try to build up a security force that can guard a whole country, that's something that's never been done there. It probably never will be after this last fiasco. But it's been really difficult, even in Iraq, as we saw. We pulled out in 2011, didn't have a whole lot of troops left there, but had to go back in 2014 because they couldn't hold back ISIS. So
do you think we'll ever go back to Afghanistan?
I certainly hope not, because if we do go back, it'll be because Al-Qaeda has put in roots and they start launching terror spectaculars again against us or our allies. At that point, we may not have any choice. Now, will we go back and try to, you know, build up the structures of government and topple the Taliban again? I doubt it. But if they start putting down roots and planning international attacks, because that's their calling card, then we might not have any choice but to go back.
James Gitfield, thank you so much.
Great to be with you, Diane, as always.
That was James Gitfield. He's a senior fellow and journalist in residence at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. His new book is titled In the Company of Heroes, The Inspiring Stories of Medal of Honor Recipients from America's Longest Wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody, with help from Sandra Baker. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.